Okay, hello everyone. My name is Ender Waters.
And I am Taylor Gates.
And this is an as yet untitled podcast about movies and other kinds of media, but mostly movies.
The power of art.
And basically, our goal is to talk about the things that we like to talk about and make all of you have to listen to us, if you so choose.
You're a masochist. Admit it.
This is true. Every section we will start, every episode that we do, which this may be the only one, we will start with a brief discussion of what we are watching, listening to, or playing at the moment, and then go in-depth on a couple of films. I pick one for Taylor to watch, and Taylor picks one for me to watch. So, Taylor, what are you watching, listening, and reading right now?
Well, at the moment, I am listening to War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Not
so interesting.
Not the, Orson Welles radio version, but just a dramatic reading of the audiobook. And it's pretty interesting because H.G. Wells never spends much time with the science portion of science fiction.
No, of course.
It's always usually more about the humanity.
Hmm.
And in the chapter I just listened to, he's trying to escape the tripods, and as he's running down the common, a local who's riding a cart is struck by a laser beam and killed.
I remember that part.
And in that moment, he spends like half a page just like with ridiculous, excessive diction describing how the destruction of the cart is like upturned and laying on the side of the path, and the wheel is like spinning of this cart. And it's like this great little moment which shows his tendency towards excess in description, but it's a great little moment of what kind of is getting at a bigger through line of what's been happening, where he's glimpsing all of these small remnants of what was life. And so he'll see these bodies that are, writhing in their final moments, or, a bug going over a dead corpse or something. And it's this kind of glimpse of there's something stirring, but it's only the momentum of what was life and is now death. And it's, I really love how he focuses in on that.
Mm. That's cool. It's been a long time since I read any H.G. Wells, but I remember always thinking that his plot ideas were great, but his actual writing ability was occasionally lacking or a little bit too pulpy for what he was trying to do.
Interesting. How so?
This is just an impression of what I remember from when I used to read H.G. Wells. I don't have a measured opinion right now.
I think of, Burroughs is too pulpy for me.
Oh, right? Burroughs is pulpy. It's just straight pulp.
Yeah.
It's no question.
But now, I think Wells exists, in that zeitgeist, but I think he manages to use that vehicle to deal with some interesting questions about existence. Whereas, on the other hand, someone like Burroughs, it's kind of more just like, it's totally just masturbation.
Well, I think what my comparison would be more to later sci-fi writers, or even contemporary writers like Jules Verne. Is that contemporary? I don't know. Aldous Huxley, for example, that have a lot of nuance in their works. But again, I haven't read any Wells in probably 10 years, so this is not a reasoned, measured opinion.
I follow you, but the last thing I want to throw in is that Wells, I think, intentionally always writes a pretentiously intellectual, in a totally British way, protagonist that is kind of semi-intentionally despicable.
Hmm.
And so a lot of the, like, the pseudo-wit in the narration, oftentimes, the way I've read it, is kind of endemic of the protagonist's own tainted view of the world.
Mm. Cool. I shall have to revisit it at some point.
How about you, Ender? What is your art consumption as of late?
Well, let's see. I just finished watching last night Amour.
Ah.
For the first time, which was heartrending. Really enjoyed it. And what else? I had to uninstall City Skylines from my computer because it was destroying my life and I was not getting any writing done. But that is a fantastic game and you should play it if you have a chance.
Give me the elevator pitch.
So imagine SimCity, but much prettier and more flexible and more fun.
Okay. So is there like more like economic functions or like what?
It's really just copy pasted from SimCity. Like,
oh, okay.
But like better in every possible way.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Didn't enjoy SimCity, then yeah, you're not gonna like it. But like you can instead of like a really strict grid system, they have a really loose grid system.
Oh, nice.
Which gives you a lot more flexibility. So like I've made lots of roads that just hug the coastline of the estuary kind of area that my city is located in. And I find that the learning curve isn't as steep as SimCity was. Okay. Yeah.
I want someone to do that for Civilization.
Have you played 6 yet?
I haven't.
Apparently, it's really fun.
Oh.
I'm too broke to buy it.
Mm, indeed.
My friends are all playing it here. Yeah, so what else?
Before you continue, could I just pick your brain about what you thought of Amour?
Oh, right. So I thought it was a really... See, this is the kind of movie that, in theory, I should be bored to tears watching.
Yeah.
But I didn't pause it. Maybe I paused it, like, to go to the bathroom or whatever. But, no, I sat through the whole thing. I thought that they didn't spend a lot of time on unnecessary drama. So, like, they skipped the second... sorry, there's going to be lots of spoilers in this podcast. They skipped the second stroke, like the event of the second stroke, and went right into what it was like dealing with the second stroke of the main character. Not the main character, the wife. And like there was a lot of what would in a Western film be, or not Western, but like American, if an American dramatic film did this, they would be like major plot points.
Yep.
And instead focused on the mundane day-to-day of caring for a person that you could see wasting away before your eyes. Now, I've never personally had to deal with that, but my mum has with her mother. And I really felt like, and you know, I've known other people that have had to go through, and I felt like I got a good insight into what that was like. But also, I think the film was really strongly hammering home its point, which is never explicitly stated except in the title, which is that love consists of the day-to-day, mundane, boring, draining tasks that you do with another person because you care about them.
Definitely. It's a verb, you know. Yeah. You know, one thing that really stood out to me about the film was the opening shot.
Yeah.
I just thought that was such a great way to set the table for, you know, you have no idea what you're about to be in for, but that perfectly looking back on it is like just the composition and the feeling, and it's like the only time really you're outside of the apartment. I just thought that was such an awesome.
Well, that's actually the second.
Oh, that's sequence. The second shot? Okay. Well, how does
Yeah, because the opening shot is her lying dead in the bed with flowers sprinkled around her and the cops showing up.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while. Right. Yeah.
And then, but then, yeah, you go to the opera or concert or whatever, and yeah, it's great, great film.
Have you ever seen Funny Games?
Funny Games, no.
Yeah, it's another film, Michael Haneke's. He made it in the 90s in Germany, and then he came to the U.S. and remade it with Tim Roth in the U.S. in the English language version. And it's insanity. Really worth the watch.
I was actually thinking that somebody should remake that Amore as a U.S. film, like, because nobody who hasn't already seen it is gonna see it as is. And I think that it would be a worthwhile film. You don't even have to do a new take on it. Just reshoot it shot for shot with English language.
Yeah, I mean,
and there would be Oscar bait for sure.
Totally, totally. I mean, he kind of did that with Funny Games, so it would be a perfect thing for him to do.
Yeah. Cool. So closing up Amore. I also, in a more mainstream spectrum, watched Deadpool finally. We talked about this, didn't we?
No, I don't think we have.
Oh, really? Yeah, so I mean, it's a Marvel film.
Back. Tell us. How do you feel, Ender?
Resounding mediocrity like every Marvel film since the first Iron Man.
I'm trying to think if I can think of an exception. Oh, yeah, okay, that's where we differ. I like Avengers, and you don't. I forgot about that.
Oh, no, I like Avengers. It's really well told. It's just mediocre as fuck. Like ultimately, like, and that's coming from somebody who has a lot of respect for Joss Whedon and what Joss Whedon usually tries to do. And he was doing all the things. It was just really safe. Really, really safe. Like every Marvel film is really, really safe.
True, but within the grounds of remaining safe at the behest of your financiers, do you think it's impossible to achieve good art?
No. I'm not, again, like, this isn't any critique of the quality of any Marvel film, really. Like, they're all very competently made. They're doing what they're trying to do very well, very efficiently. They're really fun. But the same thing over and over again, the same turn, the same blah blah over the course of, what are they at, like 12 movies now. I'm really sick of it.
Same.
And Deadpool, like, despite everyone, oh yeah, it's like, you know, it's not like other Marvel films. It's got swearing and sex and blah 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 blah. But it's still, and I really liked the like romance montage of him falling in love with the prostitute at the beginning. I thought that was charming. And like a really nice, different relationship to what we normally see in superhero movies, which is of course completely appropriate because Deadpool isn't really a superhero. But the rest of the film, despite extra blood and gore and an R rating, it was still at its core the same old, same old. And I guess that's what people want to see because that's what keeps making the money. So I'm not like faulting Marvel, really. I guess I'm just bored. I'm just bored. Bored with superhero movies.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was playing a little bit of devil's advocate there, but I totally agree with you. And I think there's an element where, you know, the broader spectrum, it just concerns me how much control Disney has over the bandwidth of cinema being made in the United States.
Yeah, that is a great point.
And that, like, that kind of is, you know, informing my concern with Marvel, even though I don't have anything against the actual management of it as a franchise. Like, I just think the bigger it gets, the more clunky it gets, and the less it's gonna cater to me. But, like, I just think in general that amount of control, that, you know, kind of having, you know, late capitalist United States, you know, I think having that much control, you know, moving much more into the corner of monopoly is just concerning as a filmmaker.
Well, and I think what they're trying to do is basically make a TV series of movies with their IPs.
Yes.
Which is obviously a very smart decision, both financially and artistically. But I do think that if they gave their directors and writers a little more freedom to shake things up, I don't know. I don't even know how I'd want them to change it. I don't know.
I would kind of throw back to, you know, a little... Oh, this is probably just influenced from script notes, but I think that I just want studios to stop killing the $15 million to $30 million films.
Yeah, agreed.
And I love those movies, and I want more of those movies. And so no matter what the reason, if, you know, anything happens to prevent that from happening, I'm not a happy audience goer.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. Like, even if there's got to be a place in it, Kick-Ass is a thing. Kick-Ass was a great movie. So it's not like there's not a place for the $15 to $30 million superhero movie. They're just not spending that money. I mean, look, at this point, Marvel could shoot a film for $10 million, and if they slapped a Marvel Studios like tag on it, the movie would make $200 million easily.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's neither here nor there. Ultimately, I'm completely apathetic about Marvel, and I don't even like any of the Marvel superheroes right now. So
my favorite Marvel superhero has always been and always will be Hulk. So I'm fucked.
All right, so just as a pre-us talking about movies in a more in-depth way, just so you know where we come from, we have a couple ways of, several ways of looking at movies, and we'll be doing primarily one or two of them. But the first, the most basic level on which you can watch a movie, is do you like it or not like it? And nobody can argue with your feeling about a movie. the way it affects you one way or the other. I like a lot of really bad movies, like 1960s kung fu films. But I think it's important to note that that liking or not liking shouldn't affect how good you think a movie is. And the quality of a film, you can also look at it two ways. One way is through a historical critique. How does this match up with historical trends? How does it follow the things that are its influences? Sort of a film theory and criticism look at it. You can look at it from creator's point of view, and Taylor and I both have film degrees, so we lean towards this. How has it technically achieved the things that it was going for? And I guess going for is the important part. What is the movie trying to do, and how well does it succeed at that attempt? And finally, there is sort of the broader cultural context in which the movie takes place. Like, so for example, one of the films we'll be discussing deals with LGBTQ issues, and how does it interact with the current social positioning of those issues in today's society. Taylor, anything to add to that?
Well, I think what I'd like to articulate is that what you started with talking about, how you respond to a film, in a lot of ways is, you know, what the film evokes in you, right? And that's completely unique for every person. And
agreed,
that's something that no matter who you are, no matter what the film is, it's completely valid, and no one can, you know, kind of steal that experience from you, no matter how great or not great the film objectively is, right? Well, that's a whole another can of worms. But I kind of want to articulate, you know, the difference there, where I've listened to some podcasts by film critics, and I think some people struggle with drawing a line between fact and opinion, or even trying to assess the art itself and simply trying to project your own personal biases and baggage onto the art itself. So whereas those two are important separate ideas, there's also the point to be made that we can't share our consciousness completely. And so there's times where we believe that, like Enderlist mentioned, what he thinks the intention of Amor was, which I think is very well articulated. But there's times, clearly, where it may not be so evident, or there may be dispute on this matter. So although it's nice to separate the two, it's not always so neat.
Yeah, and that's really important, I think, as well. Both in the way that we will come up with intellectual justifications for why we like a movie or don't like a movie, because everybody wants to think that they have good taste and they like good things. That's the whole reason we have the term guilty pleasure, is so that people can kind of cop out of liking things that they know aren't good. But also that we never have an insight into the mind, or in like never a completely clear insight into the mind or intention of the creators of a film, and so we can only judge based on what we're seeing.
Also, one mindset that is important for me when looking at how a film was made and how it impacted me and what that means for me and how I, you know, review or critique the art, is that I don't necessarily want to just be a pedant saying this is how you should have made this movie because I have a film degree. But I want to look at the primary source of the art itself, and try and decipher what it means. What is it saying? Not necessarily, you know, well, the gaffer told me offset, but to really try and consider the film in and of itself, and not just trying to be a pedantic film graduate.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, and something I may at times struggle with on this podcast because I'm a hater and like to hate things, is that taking something as a finished piece of art without worrying about the externalities, even though that completely contradicts what I just said, so I contradict myself, and just looking at its final product is really one of the only ways you can have a valid discussion, because when you start bringing in extra things, it muddies the waters substantially.
Indeed. Disclaimer. The film The Handmaiden will be discussed in great detail with extensive spoilers. So please, please, please watch the film before you listen to this podcast. It is an erotic psychological thriller and well worth your time. Finn. The first film that we will be taking a more in-depth look at is The Handmaiden. Ender, why don't you give us a summary?
So The Handmaiden is a story about two women in 1930s Japanese occupied Korea. One is a pickpocket who is sent to live as the handmaiden for a Japanese noblewoman in a mansion owned by a Korean who's obsessed with Japanese things, who is also not a very nice person. Anyway, it's actually a very intricate plot, and we'll get into some of it as we go. But the basic structure of the film is that the first part is from the handmaiden's perspective, as she tries to trick the noble lady into marrying another thief so that he can get her money, of which the handmaiden will get part of it. And then the second part is from the noblewoman's perspective, and it is revealed that everything you thought to be true is not true at all, in classic Park Chan-wook style. So Taylor, why did you suggest that I watch this film?
Well, my primary reason for suggesting it was that it blew my fucking mind. If I remember correctly, Film Crit Hulk described this as a apotheosis of his career. And
Park Chan-wook's career?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's a mess in a good way. And it's just so potent and powerful and, like, compelling and just, like, confusing and no holds barred, completely just had me by the throat. And I kind of wanted to get your feedback on how you experienced it and what you think it means, because there's a certain way in which I love this film, but I'm also extremely confused by it.
Yeah, so interesting, because I live in Korea at the moment, and I had heard a lot about this film from my friends who were like, this film is fucking amazing, you need to go see it. Usually I'm very, very bored by historical dramas, so I was like, okay, it's a historical drama about a lesbian couple in 1930s Japanese occupied Korea. But it was definitely not at all what I was expecting. And I think, like, the craftsmanship in this film is insane on every level. The way it's shot, not that it's, there's, like, only, like, one or two shots that are, like, oh my god, what a great shot. But the cinematography is gorgeous overall. Use of color is fantastic. The plotting ability in the film is ridiculous. Like, the attention to detail, the setups and payoffs are flawless and of a level of intricacy I don't even know if I've seen anything. Like, Christopher Nolan wishes he could have written this film, basically. Yeah, so on that level, it was just such a ride and so compelling.
Yeah, I strongly agree with you. There were so many moments where I had these weird sensations of glee over something that I never would anticipate. Like, for example, as we mentioned before, many spoilers will abound in this podcast, but this movie does this thing where it keeps kind of informing you a little late. Oh, you're not watching the movie you thought you were watching.
Yeah.
And when it reveals the erotic readings.
Oh man.
I thought it was such a creative, brilliant, unique, twisted take on the Gentleman's Club. And the way it is so like, when you first glimpse it, it's so simple and almost childish, but then the way it's shot and the way it's staged and the way it's set up and you know, kind of the reactions from these men that I just like developed this like hatred and repulsion for. It's just like that, you know, that's one of those moments where it's like, I never thought I would. It's like giving you, you know, giving you something you didn't know you needed or wanted.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think definitely like part two is my favorite part of the film. As you start to see Hideko's past and current life. Did you feel like you were supposed to be repulsed by the men listening to the erotica?
Not that I was supposed to, but just, I mean, as a human being.
I mean, yeah.
Like, I just, caring about this character, I automatically get defensive and then like, oh my God, like, this is like, you know, pig fucks kind of thing. But nothing constructive.
Yeah. Interesting. So I want to take a second to acknowledge, like, the massive impact that this is having on the LGBTQ community in South Korea. It's a country where most gay relationships are kept very, very under the radar. Mm-hmm. They're not socially acceptable. In the younger generation, like, as in most places in the world, it's gaining acceptance. But because it's still a very... still a pseudo-Confucian society, much disapproval would be met with if you came out in public. I don't want to talk about it too much, both for two reasons. Number one, I don't know enough about the history of gay rights in South Korea or anything like that to have an educated conversation. And number two, I'm not gay. And I don't think it's really appropriate for me to go into it in much more than, this is important and it should be recognized sense.
For sure.
I guess my central question is, and this is something I don't have worked out in my head yet, I don't have an answer to this. What do you think the theme of the film was?
Oh, I'm still, you know, it's one of those films that is still kicking around in my head and kind of, you know, in a very, very simplistic way that reflects a base lack of intelligence on my part. Lols. One of the things I loved about this film was its, you know, almost like procedural, like construction and representation of this like system of patriarchy. And then, and then them is just like this, this welling up of this resistance against
it.
One example in the film that really, I just, oh my gosh, just, I thought was so well laid out. And, you know, one of the reasons I recommended this to you was because it was so, I felt like it was quite rigorously structured. And I know you love structure, but The Bells. Initially, the patriarch, I call him, the kind of the man who runs this whole estate where the handmaiden is working. He's kind of the you know, the benefactor. He punishes, is it Hideko? Is that right?
Hideko.
He punishes her as a child using these bells. If I recall correctly, he hits her with them and then he makes her put them in her mouth. Is that right?
No, he puts one in her mouth and then he hits her hand with like a ruler or something so that she associates the taste of the bell with pain.
Exactly. And so he tells her that, you know, the line, I forget the exact words, but, you know, remember the taste of this bell. Something
like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then later, the bells play a role in sexual performance.
Yeah, so she reads a passage from one of the erotic books about two women pleasuring each other using bells.
And, you know, that totally is, I mean, you know, that room is literally, you know, demonstrating male gaze. And so that's part two of the use of the bells. And then towards the end of the film, if my memory doesn't fail me, she uses the bells in having sex with Sookie.
Well, it's one of the final shots, actually, is them getting out the bells. But the bells are actually introduced before any of that in the first act.
Okay.
They're hidden in, like, a cloth that Sookie accidentally unfolds, I think, getting it down from the drawer or something.
And so, okay, I forgot about that part. But in the overall progression of that, I, you know, kind of, I guess, skirting your question a little bit to throw this in there, but I had this, like, this feeling, like, when it ended on that note, it's like, she remembered those bells, you motherfucker. And I remember, my notes from it, I listed it as step one, patriarch punishing imperfect female clay. Step two, sexual performative narrative about erotic pleasure for the male gaze or some shit with commentary about the love triangle that is forming. Step three, fuck yeah, lesbians triumph in love on the ocean.
Indeed.
But I come down to it, I'm not really sure what I think this film means. Do you have any conclusive ideas?
Yeah, there's so much going on here. It's almost like a Dark Knight situation where there's like 50 different possible themes. But I think, unlike Dark Knight, we could tease out a single unifying one. But it might take a term paper to do it. So instead of tackling that difficult question, let's talk about my favorite character, the dirty old man.
Let's hear it.
So this guy is... it's probably my favorite part of the film. Because he's so just bizarrely disgusting, but not in any way that you would expect him to be disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy is obsessed with books, obsessed with erotica. He's got a library full of hundreds of thousands of books of it. He, for some reason that is never really explained, likes painting his tongue black with ink. Writing ink. But he's not obsessed with sex, which is what's interesting, is that you never see him, like, make a sexual move towards any of the other characters in the film. He's literally just obsessed with the actual, like, erotic art form. And I thought that was just a really interesting choice and a really, first of all, what a great paradox, like, just from a craftsmanship perspective, what a great paradox in a character. What a great, like, oh, interesting way, like, interesting thing for a character to be formed around. And his pursuit of that thing, whatever the jollies he gets from watching a woman read erotic text to him, is so narrow-minded that he commits, like, practically unspeakable acts of horror in order to obtain it. Anything to add there?
Yeah, I just, in kind of tangentially related to that, I love how, like, initially, you know, I remember there, I forget who exactly asked it, but there was this question of, like, why, who cares about this library? Like, why do these books matter? And then as the story builds, you kind of start to realize this like, strange, like, it's not, like, financial worth. You know, there's this, like,
exactly,
it starts to be imbued with this, like, almost, you know, like, almost, like, otherworldly sexual, like, potency. It's like the be-all, end-all for this man. And it's, yeah, just, man, I've never really seen a character like that.
He looks like Heihachi as well from Tekken, which to me made it even more funny and interesting. The last scene of the film, or is it, maybe it's the penultimate scene in the film, I can't remember, but, like, I thought that was a really interesting scene, and perhaps, like, a way, maybe a key to one of the parts of the theme, and it's him punishing the thief, using bookmaking supplies. So he's chopping off fingers with a guillotine and etc. But then, like, in the middle of that, he's like, yeah, so tell me about your night with Hideko, please, like, I'm just a dirty old man that likes, I'm just an old man that likes dirty stories. And I thought that, like, patriarchal punishment of one man for depriving another man of sexual gratification was an interesting contrast. And perhaps something that would be key to the rest of the film. I don't know. There's a sense in which, in the end, it's just two men left talking about sex. Yeah, two men talking about sex and two women actually having sex.
And yeah, no, that's such a great parallel contrast. And it's kind of like, that's, in a sense, that's all they are. You know, and then, like, his library, you know, which has been at this point, you know, almost destroyed, you know, is like a reflection.
Exactly.
It's just a hollow, you know, scrawled, you know, narrative of something that never happened.
And even Fujiwara, the Count Fujiwara, who's the thief, you never see him sleeping with anyone in the film. In fact, you see him trying near the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, his desire for money, he says, it's not really the money that I'm after. It's the manner of ordering wine without looking at the price.
Yeah. Bougie.
Well, and that's like exactly the same, basically, as the other male character in the film, the old man, who was a Korean Japanese interpreter that was obsessed with Japan,
mm-hmm.
and kind of finagled his way into becoming as close to Japanese as he possibly could be. And I think that there's a really strong class element in the film as well.
Definitely.
And sort of like the union of patriarchal, like, class and gender roles being subverted by two women who don't really give a fuck.
Yeah. And in kind of the men debating their different, you know, beauty standards of what the perfect woman is, which is kind of what, like, they're both trying to turn Hideko into their own, you know, perfect woman. She's just like this clay to them. It's just, I don't know. I love that, you know, like, back and forth where it's, you don't even, like, there's this question that in that final scene with them where it's like, I don't even know who has the upper hand, like, even though, like, he's killing him and then he's, you know, smoking his poison cigarette. It's like, you don't even know, like, because it's just these two men complicit in killing themselves.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought of that. Sort of the mutual suicide sans women in the picture while the women are making love.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I think possession is, like, for me, at the core of this film. You know, that this film, I mean, is, you know, just quite erotic. But I think there's this distinction, you know, that develops in the union of the two women. There's an element of when they're together, it's not about possession. It's about, like, expression and affection. And, and you know, you get to the end and it's like, you know, well, you can possess a book. And that's the extent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of like the sexual fantasy, you know, like where the sexual fantasy meets reality and you realize what you actually have and it's nothing.
Yeah, that's another great point. And that kind of ties in nicely to one big thing I wanted to talk about, which was the sort of use of objectification and the male gaze and all of that in the film, which is obviously a major recurring motif in the film in every part. And you're first exposed to it when Suki is dressing Hideko and she says, "Ladies are just dolls for their maids to dress up," while commenting, not like sexually explicitly, but like very sort of tenderly about how beautiful this woman is. And so you contrast that with sort of the made up, well, with another kind of gaze that takes place in the erotic reading room. And also in the books in the erotic reading room. And then you contrast that again with the film itself, which features very explicit sex scenes. You don't see... Do you see vagina? I don't think you see... But, like, there are definitely no clothes, and you... If the camera angle was slightly different, you would definitely be seeing vagina. And it's fairly arousing. Like, the sex scenes are fairly arousing.
Definitely.
So I just think it's interesting, and especially in the cultural context of South Korea, in which pornography is banned, and the culture as a whole, even though it's not really, pretends to be very sexually conservative, to have this kind of contrast going on. I think maybe Chan-wook is saying something, definitely about male gaze and about possession, like you were talking, but also maybe something about hypocrisy. I don't know. What do you think?
Something that comes to mind for me is Pride and Prejudice, oddly, because I think that it being a Welsh novel, and when you come in, you know, this, I believe it's a housemaid. Is it a housemaid that introduces her to the estate when she first arrives?
So it's a housemaid that you find out later was the old man's former wife.
That's right.
Who he still shares a bed with.
So messed up. And she kind of like walks her through, you know, the history of, you know, this portion of the estate is Japanese architecture and this portion of the estate is Gothic architecture. And there's an element where, you know, I Pride and Prejudice comes to mind because I think of, you know, this really, you know, antiquated role that has been designated as the realm of woman, you know, with no social mobility. Like, this is the realm of woman. And you know, there is that really high sense of propriety, but then at the same time, there's like a complete, you know, subjugation of woman. And there's like, there's kind of this like undertone of woman's entire purpose is to serve man. And a great portion of that has to do with sexual service.
Yeah.
And so to me, you know, like this hypocrisy you're talking about brings, I don't know if that's what you're getting at, but it brings that to mind where it's like, it's taking that in its very subtle form and, you know, these very dainty period pieces. And it's being like, no, let's take a look, you know, at how, you know, we have this system in place and we have the way people, you know, comport and present themselves. But then this is what is actually expected of woman.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that might have, I don't think that theme would play as well to an American or European audience, or like not play as well, but be as resonant to an American or European audience, just because sexuality is so much more open in the West, or has been for the last 60, 70 years. But you definitely, and that's even true in the first part of the film, which is from the maid's perspective, where there's no sense that this is anything other than a very proper house. That the old man is a little bit weird, but everything else is just kind of what it is until the forbidden lesbian feelings begin to surface. So in that first part of the film, you really get the feeling that you would assume that we're supposed to feel like Suki has as well, that this is kind of a forbidden relationship, forbidden thing, that you can't let anybody find out about it, and that it has no future anyway.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, have you seen, I'm blanking on the name, the Guillermo del Toro's latest film with Tom Hiddleston? Crimson Peak. Have you seen Crimson Peak?
No.
I think, you know, I'll go to Crimson Peak as an example of not doing what The Handmaiden did so well, is the gradual reveal. You know,
yeah.
The pacing,
yeah.
Of, you know, not just, you know, like there's this scene in that film that gives, like, in one monologue as he's touring her through the house, he gives like 8 points, you know, in like 30 seconds of like red flag, red flag, red flag, red flag, yeah. Red flag, you know what, yeah. I mean? And it's this beautiful like slow reveal. I kind of want to reference the 2012 Hong Kong Chinese Korean co-production of The Thieves, which was a complete rip off of Ocean's 11 in a totally like self-conscious, hilarious way. Yeah. But where they, in that film, there was this obnoxious use of the con man, like, who is he conning? Is it his lover or his lover's love, you know? And
yeah.
I really think that's a fine line to walk when you're dealing with all of the baggage of, you know, the genre you're in. And there's an element where in this movie, when, you know, there's a scene where we're standing in front of the insane asylum and you don't know which person, which woman is going to be checked into the insane asylum.
Mm.
And I'm sitting there as a viewer watching that scene. And this is stepping away from theme, just talking about artifice, but it's exceptional how I have no knowledge of who's being checked in. And it doesn't have that tenor of the kind of like pithy, you know, lazy storytelling where it's like, who is it going to be? But it actually is very motivated because you have an element of not knowing all the details, not knowing all the facts, but you understand where each of these characters is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And that really charges it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to throw something else out there. I thought the idea of him giving her a vial of opium as a wedding gift was this beautiful symbol in the film. Like the means of near instant suicide, sealing the pact between them with already, you know, having this background of suicide, right? And then like marriage, a bond till death, that has a built-in escape, the escape of death itself.
Yeah.
And like, even if he is playing her, you know, maybe she thinks, oh, like this will save me. But then, you know, well, like what if it's not actually opium? And you know, there's just this, I feel like in the whole movie, there was this element where everything, there was this like feeling, I don't think superposition is the exact word I'm looking for, but everything felt like it was a lie and the truth at the same time.
You know,
there was this duality to everything. And it just always kept me guessing. And at the end, I felt like I was so impressed that they were able to sustain that through the entire film.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There are so many layers to this film and so many things to talk about. Somebody is going to have to write their thesis paper on this in order to really figure it out, because we don't have time for that right here, unfortunately.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Very much so. Great film. So I suggested that Taylor watch the 1947 Laurence Olivier black and white version of the Hamlet play by William Shakespeare. So, Taylor, please give us a plot summary for anyone who hasn't seen. I guess if you haven't seen Hamlet before, then you should read it or watch it first before listening to this. But really?
In Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, we see the story unfold of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, who is thrown into a fit of despair when his father, the king, unexpectedly dies. And very quickly after his death, his mother marries his uncle. Soon after this, his despair is exacerbated even further by a visitation from his father's spirit, informing him that he was murdered by his uncle and now stepfather. Leaving Hamlet with the decision, should he kill the king? Should he take vengeance for his father? And thus unfolds a web of political machinations and a cycle of death, revenge, and lots of human suffering.
Okay, so Taylor, I gave you a list of films that I had been watching, and you picked this one, so why don't you talk a little bit about why you picked it and what your immediate response was to it?
So initially I picked this because of the films you sent me. This is one I was already interested in because I remember reading that Olivier directed and starred in it. And, you know, when I read that, I kind of had this thought in my mind of like, oh, this kind of sounds like, you know, something Orson Welles would do. And so I kind
of, an apt comparison.
Indeed. And I kind of wanted to check it out. Also, I'm fairly uneducated, unexposed when it comes to Shakespeare. So it's an area that I have to learn and grow. And so I picked it. And it took me a while to get through because there was a lot of pausing and kind of making sure I understood what happened and revisiting beautifully composed passages. But I have to say, I loved, unabashedly loved this film. I've really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, I've seen a few screen versions of Hamlet. This is the first one that has really resonated with me.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, even having read Hamlet, just the way this was performed, I think it really shows, you know, that Olivier has, you know, this kind of theatrical background, because he's so familiar with the text and like so like the way it's like wielded like a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, his performance kind of reminds me of Sydow in, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but in the Seventh Seal, Ingmar Bergman's film.
Mm-hmm.
But just like, he's just so completely, it's like alive in the role. It was so enjoyable, his performance itself. But let's, you know, step aside from the internal fan in me getting out of control, and let's even just talk about the first shot. Okay, the shot behind the title, you see these waves, you know, dark at night, crashing on these rocks beneath the castle, and it's like this great framing of portent, you know, of what will come. And then from there we cut to this aerial static shot of the castle, and it is just, I love this castle. You know, through the whole film, the film feels, you know, it does in a lot of ways feel very theatrical. It does feel, you know, there's lots of ways where the blocking, some of the sets / what you might call them stages, feel very much like a stage production. But it manages to blend the two in a way that I really enjoyed, and just was, I don't know, I guess hands down just blown away by the overall cast. It's just so impressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, when I watched this film, the only reason I watched this film is because it won Best Picture in 1947.
Okay.
And not what I was expecting at all. Just from a purely, let's set aside the acting for a minute, because obviously phenomenal, but from a purely from the point of view of the cinematography and the production design, holy fuck, like one of the most visually intense films I've ever seen in my life. The framing and the lighting and the gorgeous, like, sparse design of the film all blend together to create one of the bleakest mise-en-scenes I've ever seen in my life, and I loved it.
Yes.
It, like, I told Taylor when I was describing the movie initially, like, it feels like somebody got F.W. Murnau or Fritz Lang or one of the old school German expressionist directors to direct a Shakespearean production, just because of the sheer, and it's rarely non-naturalistic in its expression. You don't get like crazy painted shit like in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or anything like that, but it's so visually intense from beginning to end, that, like, just the sheer, like, visual effect on you is insane.
Yeah, and there's almost, to me, with the lighting, I felt like it was a marriage of naturalistic lighting and expressionistic lighting.
Well, it's almost like they were like, okay, how can we naturalistically have expressionist lighting.
Yeah.
Like, because all the lighting feels like it could be motivated. Like, okay, I can see how that shadow would be cast by a tiny little window in the ceiling of this dark castle. I can see, like, how, oh yeah, we're only getting light into this room through that open door down the hall, like, 30 meters or whatever.
I do want to just interject and say, Ender and I do dislike things. That does happen. You know, I know this copious amount of praise and just, like, adoration is, you know, it's...
We're not going to talk about films we really hate, though, probably, hopefully.
That would be bad self-care. Like, let's be honest. Yeah. Like, come on. But, yeah, absolutely. And I think, I love, specifically, I know I'm going way too specific here, but when he delivers the line, but I have within which passeth show these but the trappings and the suits of woe. I love, like, in that opening scene, and it carries out through the entire film, this movie reflecting the background in theater is so well blocked.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
in that absolutely. Sequence, flawlessly. It establishes these characters, and, you know, like, when like, a servant comes to speak to Hamlet or something, and he's running after them, you know, it's just, like, man, like, you know, you can talk all you want about, you know, hallway Sorkin scenes. This film is so well blocked.
Fuck hallway Sorkin scenes. Like, so, yeah, like, just the performances, there's no weak points. There were no weak points in the whole cast, I didn't think.
I agree.
Olivier's Hamlet, like you were saying, was just in command of the role in a way that I haven't seen in a long time. I think you don't get as much of that in a lot of films today anymore, because so much of it is very under rehearsed and undershot, for lack of a better word.
And I would also, like, add that there's this no one respects a script like they respect Shakespeare.
Well, or theatrical scripts in general.
Yeah, like the show book, right? You know, yeah. Like, it's just, and so there's an element of, like, you know, in this, like, I mean, and obviously, you know, it should be present in a lot more productions of Shakespeare's work, but
yeah,
there's this like this love and kind of labor of love for that text.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, once again, this is probably me being influenced by podcasts to listen to, but I do feel like there is a lack of respect, you know, in a lot of media for, you know, by actors for, you know, screenplays.
Well, and I think the part of the problem is that there's so much bad text out there.
It's true.
That doesn't deserve to be respected. Like, that needs a little something from the actors or the director in order to make it watchable. Unfortunately, when you do enough of those, that sort of cynicism carries over to scripts that do deserve respect. But in theater, you don't have that culture at all. The script is kind of God, and yep. If you deviate from it, you're kind of going to hell. I'm sure, I haven't looked this up, maybe I will now. I'm sure Olivier had played Hamlet on stage before he shot this film.
I believe, from the reading I was doing, I believe he did.
And so, this is, like, such a great example of a situation, even in sort of 1947, that's peak Golden Hollywood, that's peak studio system.
Yeah.
Granted, I think this is a British film.
Yes.
So maybe not quite as applicable, but even in peak, you have someone coming in, writing, or doing cuts to the to the original stage play, acting and directing, and being so comfortable with the material and so knowing exactly what each line does, exactly how the audience is going to respond to each line, because again, he's done it on stage hundreds of times, probably hundreds of shows of this, and then bending all of that to his will and creating just a phenomenal film. I really think, even, you know, it's not going to be as accessible to people today unless you like old movies. If you don't like old movies, this movie is going to be incredibly difficult to get through.
Definitely. Brevity is not the the doctor's orders, no, in this case.
It's 2 hours, 40 minutes, or 2.5 hours?
Yeah, 2:33.
It's 2.5 hours, and really savors every scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, just absolutely phenomenal. I remember there was one point when I was watching the film where the king had his first like monologue, and I was just like, oh shit, like, you're a really, really good actor as well. Like, that was a fantastic monologue that you just delivered, and I didn't even realize how good you were until now, because this is the first time when you're supposed to actually be a character in a scene instead of just a prop for Hamlet.
Yeah, and it to me, there's an element where it's like, oh, a Shakespeare film that isn't fan fiction? What? Like, oh, it just, yeah, it's sublime. For me, like, there's an element where this was me, like, experiencing Hamlet for the first time, even though I've seen other forms of it. I'm gonna confess with you, I have never understood the power of the line "to be or not to be." Like, I've like always like been like, why the fuck does everyone like care about this line so much? Like, it's not that great. Like, you know, it's sat in all, like, everywhere all the time in all these different films, and I never like understood it. And then in that scene when he's like looking over the cliff down at the waves with like a dagger in his hand, and he's like trying to decide like what to do, and it's like this moment of like existential angst, and like he has this shadow of his father's death hanging over him, and this call to revenge, to murder the incumbent king, and it's like, man, that is like a powerful question, to be or not to be.
And he's also contemplating suicide at the same time, don't
forget. Exactly. No, exactly. That's the thing that like charges it so well. It's this great image where he's looking, and, you know, he ends up dropping the dagger over. But it's like, you know, this great moment that epitomizes the indecisive nature of Hamlet. And to me, that was the first time that line ever made sense, because it's so, so much more, you know, like, imbued with this struggle of kind of, he's like iterating between these, you know, different options, where it's like, do I suffer like the woe that is being placed on me and carry through it, or do I just, you know, end it all? Yeah, it's just, man, I don't know. That was just so, so strong, that scene.
So let's talk about, I agree with you, that is fantastic scene. But let's talk a little bit about this as adaptation. And obviously the original Hamlet, like most Shakespearean tragedies, and actually more than I think any other Shakespearean tragedy, there's just so much going on, and it would be very difficult to bring it to screen in a cohesive way. So whenever you're adapting something, you have to decide like what your take is going to be on it. And especially with Shakespeare, when there's usually historical things going on, there's existential questions going on, there's relational questions going on. So what do you think? Olivier kind of spells out really clearly at the beginning of the film, in the one piece of extra Shakespearean dialogue or extra Shakespearean text, what his goal is in the film. And you just touched on it, that this is the story of a man who couldn't make up his mind. So what other ways do you think he successfully accomplishes that that goal, because it's been a few years since I read the play, but I do think in the original play there's extra passages that make his resolve is a little bit more set.
I know this is like a secondary source, but in kind of doing some reading on the film, there was a lot of content from the kind of original, you know, kind of more rough cut of the film that was cut, that was like all like kind of political intrigue. And I think that's great, because there's an element where so much of this movie as it stands is love, revenge, and the fallout.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'd like love leading to revenge, you know, and it's just this like cycle of, you know, it's like, I love how, you know, there's this element where the woman who wants Hamlet's love, Ophelia, doesn't get his love, and in fact has the man who does love her own father, taken from her by the man who didn't give her love. Like, it's just, you know, so poetic. But there's this element, I think, where I love that it focuses in, you know, not so much on, you know, the bigger political spectrum of it, but really on these relationships. And it's almost like the castle, you know, it's this labyrinth. It's this labyrinth, and the stones of the castle, you know, they're the witness to this tragedy.
Mm.
You know, you get to the end of it and, you know, none of these characters are standing, right?
Yeah.
Other than Horatio. But I think there's an element where, I guess one way that I really, really enjoyed the depiction of his indecision is in his relationship with Ophelia.
Mm, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
because definitely. It's just, oh man, it's so poignant and like so touching, and at the same time, like, makes me hate him a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's such a, for aspiring screenwriters, like, it's such a great object lesson as well. Have your theme playing out in microcosm, in your B story, at the same time as it's playing out like in your A story. Because Hamlet's, you can just see like, oh, Hamlet's indecision in his relationship with Ophelia is probably the reason she went mad after her father died. Because if he had been supportive and like consistent with the things he was saying to her, there would have been more emotional support for her there. But as it was, she was left completely bereft of family and love, and suffered a mental breakdown as a result. And in the A story, his like indecision, what's really interesting is that he never really makes up his mind. He's pushed into doing what the ghost wants him to do as a result of everyone else making decisions for him. And instead of taking the best shot he had, because it wasn't perfect, he ends up killing everyone, basically.
Yeah. I loved how you had this element of where there's this question of like, does love lead to revenge? You know, and you have like this filial love, and you have this like erotic love, you know, and you have like, you know, fidelity, you know, being broken or committed, but there's this element of like, you know, well, you know, Ophelia, oh, she killed herself because Hamlet killed her father, and I'm her brother. So, you know, does love lead to revenge? And, you know, I don't know. I thought that was, you know, the repetition of that, I really enjoyed. And the other thing that I thought really touched on the indecision is, you know, the famous line, get thee to a nunnery.
Yeah.
In the, you know, in the parlance of the time, nunnery also meant brothel, right? And so there's this...
Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, I was reading about this. There's this kind of, this great, you know, conflict of, you know, he's saying this to her, and he even says these really, you know, sexist, you know, lines where, you know, he says like, oh, you know, you just paint, you know, and you just name God's creatures, you know, and Mary Wollstonecraft would be totally, totally furious at his statements. But he goes on about, you know, get thee to a nunnery, and there's this kind of conflict of, is he saying like, protect her because I love her and I want her out of this, you know, because I'm gonna have to, you know, kill the king and I don't want her to be hurt? Or is he saying like, you are a harlot and a whore and you know, just go, you know, live out your lascivious life? Or at the same time, like, going back to the other side, is he saying that he thinks she's so pure that, you know, he can't have her? Like, there's this complete conflict in that line, and he like repeats it over and over, and then he's angry at her, and it's like he's taking out his own Oedipus complex on her as this representation of his mother. It's just, I thought there was really something wrapped up in that sequence of kind of the theme of the entire film.
Yeah, definitely.
My closing comment on this film would be Claudius, once again, if you're playing the home game and you're kind of lost, Claudius is currently the king for, you know, for the duration of the film. He's the king, and he's the man who murdered Hamlet's father and then married his mother, his uncle, Hamlet's uncle. Claudius dies without the crown he killed for, at the foot of a vacant throne by the poison of his own treachery.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a shot that I fucking love.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing. Closing shot of the film. Yeah, him just reaching for the crown. Did he get it? I can't remember.
No.
If he grasped it or not.
He put it on his head and then it dropped right before he fell and died.
Yep. Yeah, so good.
Exceptional.
So much great imagery in that film. But I think we are just about out of time.
Yeah.
So this was fun. Great films this week.
Now, Ender, I don't want you to forget the most important tradition that we have practiced for years and years.
Of doing this podcast.
Yes. The tradition is, at the end of the podcast, you must pick one deceased director who will be reanimated.
Okay.
And brought back to life to continue his or her discography. But...
oh, God.
In the manner of Pushing Daisies, the cost is two living directors must die immediately.
Okay. I would reanimate Orson Welles. Oh, I think we need to make it a rule as well that the directors that we kill have to stay dead.
So yes.
I can't kill them again next episode.
Okay.
So I would reanimate Orson Welles and kill Michael Bay and James Cameron.
Why did I let you go first?
Sorry.
No, I'm just joking. Oh, man.
This is going to get us in trouble if we ever actually get work in the industry.
This would probably be only for our own amusement. I would love to get in trouble, be at that level in the industry.
I know. Have enough people listening to this podcast that we get in trouble.
Final Draft is a horrible application. We just gained 10 listeners. Yeah. Or whatever the staff, 40? 40? Yeah. So I would reanimate Billy Wilder.
Okay.
I would kill Alexander Payne.
Okay, what did he direct?
The Descendants. I'm trying to remember what else.
Okay.
Just kind of meh. I would kill Alexander Payne and Roland fucking Emmerich.
Poor Roland Emmerich.
Bastard.
Poor Roland Emmerich. I mean, The Day After Tomorrow, that movie actually is what convinced me that climate change was real.
That's awesome.
And it wasn't when I watched the film. Because I watched the film when I was like 13 or something. I was like, oh, this is a cool adventure film. And then the polar vortex came in a couple years ago for the first time, and I was like, holy shit, this is exactly what they predicted was going to happen if climate change was real in the day after tomorrow. So I guess climate change must be real. Obviously, there was a more nuanced discussion than that about the actual science, but that was like the gist of it. I was like, oh, shit.
And in the same way that you chose James Cameron, who has given the best gifts he will ever give to cinema in the past, Roland Emmerich has laid his golden eggs and is done with them.
Wait, you don't want to see 2020, the movie?
I'm sure if I'm living in Asia, it will be a bestseller, but I'll pass.
It's all about the Weihaken calendar and how it ends in the year 2020. No?
Oh, dear.
Tough crowd. Okay. And that is our show for this time around. We do not have a consistent updating schedule, but you'll probably be hearing from us again. I am Ender Waters. You can find me at Ender Waters on Twitter.
I am Taylor Gates. You can find me at Dreyfus, Dreyphus, on Twitter.
And we hope you enjoyed listening to our podcast.